All right. We're in the middle of a study on the history of Christianity. Last week, what did we talk about? Who was here that remembers? We talked about the councils. Yes. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to name them all. Because that's okay. We talked about the councils from Nicaea 1 to Nicaea 2. Crossed a lot of years in that time period. Today, and again, what we're trying to do is we are approaching the study of the history of Christianity, trying to understand it both in linear terms, but also the multiple conversations that should be going on. Because as we understand Christianity, as we understand almost anything, that there is a flow of history that has a lot of streams that are converging at different points to do different things. And for sure, as we'll see tonight, three significant streams that happened began that sort of a confluence of things that were going on that have led us to the state of the church today. And while we'll not get to it by the end of this study and this semester, when we get to it at the end of next semester, you'll begin seeing how this all flows together, these different things that had happened. Tonight, we're going to be talking about world changers. We're going to be talking about three individuals. We're going to be talking about Constantine, Gregory the Great, and Muhammad. And you could honestly put the Great after all three of these. Because Constantine is known as Constantine the Great, Gregory as Pope Gregory the First or Gregory the Great, and you could honestly put it behind Muhammad, depending upon how you want to interpret that. And what we want to do is we want to think about three individuals who really changed the world. And changed the world and influenced Christianity in a significant way. Now, when we think about world changers, think about for the last 500 years or so, who are some world changers that you can think of? Okay, Steve Jobs. They will write about Steve Jobs for generations to come because he had an influence. Who else? Napoleon? Yeah, Napoleon was a significant one. Who else? Yeah, Adolf Hitler. Again, world changers don't have to have changed the world for good. They could be the negative side of history, for sure. Any, a couple others?
Columbus.
Columbus? Yeah, Christopher Columbus, who in 1492 sailed the ocean. Yes, and we no longer celebrate his holiday. We still do. But yeah, we heard over here Charles Darwin, for sure. It was somebody that sort of had happened. And one last one, yeah. Martin Luther. Yeah, we'll see that Martin Luther was a world changer. And then also and who else?
Lenin and Stalin,
yeah. Lenin probably, both Lenin and Stalin for different reasons. Lenin got the whole Russian Empire going and Stalin tried to kill everybody. But one of the things that happened, they did change the world. With that. And one of the things that's interesting is that oftentimes world changers are accidents in history. You know, Darwin didn't start out trying to change the world. He was just a guy who was interested in the different things that were going on these islands. You think about Martin Luther. Martin Luther didn't want to reform the church. I'm sorry, Martin Luther didn't want to change the church. He wanted to reform the church. He actually would have preferred at certain points until he got excommunicated and then he sort of went off the deep end. In a good way, he actually wanted to keep his reform within the church and to purify the church. That was his goal. He didn't want to set out to create Lutherans, but ultimately we see that the Reformation happened that way. In this way, there are people that come about in history, and sometimes they are world changers not because of something in themselves. World changers are people that fundamentally change a culture and that we will remember. That we'll write about for generations. We'll think about them. That they are people who, whether they did it themselves or they're representative of a movement of the age, are unique. But these three guys that we're going to look at are really three people who fundamentally changed the world. And what we want to do is I'm going to be using sort of the conversation that we've used in the past of having our notes here. So make sure you have those. That's going to be a good outline. But in behind me tonight, I'm going to use a little bit more imagery that we're going to try to bring together a few things where we can. to try to help explain things. So without any ado, let's just get into it. We're going to talk about Constantine. Now, Constantine, in sort of the format that I have for all three of these guys, is a significant force in the history of Christianity because he brought Christianity to the national, to the global stage. He brought Christianity out of its persecution complex, the place where it was a persecuted group of people that occupied a minority status in the empire. And by the end of his reign, Christianity would be the dominant religion in the empire. So we begin, we see this is, if I can get to it, this is a statue of Constantine that is in York, England. Since God hadn't created the person who created the camera, they didn't have that yet. So this is a good statue of Constantine that we have. These are his life dates. March 27th, 272 to May 22nd, 337. His mother was Helena, and she was a very significant influence in his life. His father was Constantinius, and he would ultimately have definitely one wife, maybe two. Minervina, what we think was definitely his concubine, because he had a son by her named Crispus. But we're not entirely sure that they got married, because in order for him to become emperor of Rome, he had to marry Fausta, which is always some interesting stuff that goes on with this. And again, we're not dealing with the nuclear or nuclear family here. We're dealing with messy people and messy times. And the thing that we learn about the as it went with the Greeks, as it goes with the Romans, it's good to be the king, but it's interesting how people become kings, so to speak. It's good to be Caesar. It's interesting how you become Caesar. A lot of this ends up being, I married this person to get in good with her dad and all that, because if you remember from the movie Gladiator, which is actually, I think, a fairly good movie historically as it depicts some stuff, Marcus Aurelius is the Caesar who is at that, who is there, and he is commenting to his daughter that if she had only been born a male, that what a Caesar she would have made, because even in this time, societies were still led, were dominated by patriarchy, which is male-led leadership. So it would never have been possible to have a female Caesar. Ultimately, he is the emperor of Rome. This is the role that Constantine takes on. It's a really interesting story how it all happens, because as we'll see as we go through his significant life events, it wasn't just, Constantine was born, so he's going to be the king one day. Sort of like we're seeing over in the United Kingdom right now, or in Britain, where we have a new king, a new King George that will come, but he's a prince right now, and he's like this tall. But, you know, he's going to be a king one day. We know that's going to happen because of the lineage thing. Here, this is very in flux. This isn't a simple line of succession that's going on with this. So let's look at, this is another picture that I have here of him. If you actually have ever been to Rome, has anybody ever been to Rome here? I figured we'd get some hands. Yeah. If you actually go to Rome and you're going through the sort of the Colosseum complex, but you're also going through the Roman Forum, or what's left of it, you're going to run into some really cool stuff. And back behind the Forum is this massive, the remains of this massive statue called the Colossus. And this statue used to stand 40 feet tall. And it's a statue of Constantine. And it's there in pieces, as you can see there. And it's really interesting how you find that. You have to sort of go out of your way to find it, because it's just not right in the middle of everything. But it's pretty neat when you walk up to it. And just to see how huge this whole thing was. But it represented who Constantine thought he was. He was bigger than the world. He was bigger than life itself. Because he was Caesar of Rome. He was Caesar of Rome during a time where Rome could have begun capitulating very soon, or could have lasted a little longer. And because of Constantine and some other things that went on, it ultimately ends up lasting a little bit longer. So some significant life events that we want to go through. So obviously he was born in 272, but in 293, Diocletian appoints two junior emperors over the East and the West. This ultimately was part of the way that they wanted to divide the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire was unwieldy at the time. I mean, it was ranging all the way from all the way up from Britannia down to Gaul, into what is now modern North Africa, all the way through Sinai Peninsula. I mean, it's just a massive, hulking empire. And in order to better run it administratively, there are a lot of things that went on during this time to try to do that. Diocletian created something called the Tetrarchy, and as he did that, he created these different roles. But then through a series of events, the things that happen, in 306, Constantine becomes the emperor of Rome. In 307, he marries Fausta, and she becomes the empress of Rome. Shortly thereafter, he appoints his mother, Augusta Imperix, Imperatrix, and this gives her a very prominent role. She has unlimited access to the Roman treasury and some things that go on with that. And she has a significant influence on Constantine's life. It'd be nice, I'm sure, if some of your kids would give you unlimited access to a treasury. But she gets to go around and do some fun stuff because, you know, she gets to do that. One of the things that goes on, and then we see again that Galerius dies, removing the Tetrarchy. Galerius was sort of put in charge of many of the eastern parts of that that were going on. But then again, because these are people that are, when it comes time to change Caesars, you change Caesars a couple different ways. One person dies and another person easily takes over. Usually didn't happen. For instance, back in 69, or 68, I guess you could say, after Nero died, there was a period in 69 where we had four Caesars, and they were all going around trying to give each other, they're trying to get the most support to who was ultimately going to be brought in as the Caesar at the time. People would murder each other, they'd have scandal, all this kind of thing, and ultimately Vespasian comes in, and he establishes himself through a series of miracles. He had the army behind him. It always helps having 10,000 guys behind you with swords. Whenever you walk into the place, the church will find this out in the Middle Ages. But one of the things, it's not always easy how this happens. But Maxentius was trying to claim the Roman throne as well at this time. And it was challenging because at this point, Constantine is worried about whether his army is going to be able to take him. Now, in the series of battles that had gone on, where they had sort of both been going at each other, Constantine was carefully positioning his troops, and he really understood his adversary well. But we understand that through this time that Constantine had a vision, and that vision was of the Christian Cairo, or the Cairo that came to him. And I think, this is the Cairo. I'll just give the other thing right there, too. You'll notice that it's sort of an X with a P if you're English, if you speak, English. But if you're going with Greek, they're the two letters of Chi and Rho, which are the first two letters of Christ's name in Greek, which is Christos. Cairo, Iota, Soma, Tau, Upsilon, Soma. And one of the things that goes on with that is, this becomes the image that is sort of given to Constantine, and he goes and he takes it and he puts it on all of the armaments of the Roman soldiers that are there to defend him and his claim. And it gets so bad that some of his enemies tell their troops, don't look at their emblems because you'll be taken away by the god of Constantine and he'll ruin you and you'll become a zombie is essentially what happens. So this is very demoralizing because you'll become a zombie if you fight these people. It's not good for troop morale. So Constantine ultimately wins this battle, and now he becomes ultimately the full Roman emperor. But shortly thereafter, he issues the Edict of Milan in 313. And the Edict of Milan allowed Christianity to become legal throughout the Roman Empire. Now, what's important is that there was an Edict of Toleration in 311 that was passed that was sort of ending... ending the Diocletian persecution. This was that Christianity would be tolerated as a religion in the Roman Empire. But throughout this time, it was still not legal to be a Christian. So now Constantine, having taken on the God of Christianity as his identity, now establishes Christianity, legalizes it, and begins following Christianity. Now, We say that Constantine begins following Christianity, and there is a lot of discussion among scholars on whether we can call Constantine a Christian. Because if you look down to the last date under his significant life events, what do you see? You see that he's baptized on Easter just prior to his death. So, again, now there's a couple reasons for that. And again, this is sort of the way scholars get to have fun conversations and conferences, which sounds as exciting as it is. One of the things that they do is they talk about why did Constantine delay his baptism? Well, because he wanted to sin as much as possible. Personally, I don't understand that. I pray for my food at the beginning of the year, and I just expect God to bless it. It's sort of one of those things. But the idea there is that he believed that he could sin as much as he wanted to, and then he could be baptized when he was on his deathbed. And this wasn't the baptism that we use. He wasn't submerged. This was a sprinkling baptism, even though that wasn't the dominant form of the church. So we will skip down, but we're going to go back to the Edict of Milan. Now, in 324, he defeats Licinius at the Battle of Chrysopolis. And this is really the last person that challenges him. He's going through, the Cairo is on the shields, it's on the armaments. He's going through, and this is Constantine really beginning to establish himself. One of the things that goes on is that he begins the process of moving the capital from Rome. So you begin moving the capital from Rome for a number of reasons, because Constantine was, if he is nothing else, a really good politician, but an even better strategist. If you've ever been to Rome and you've driven around Rome, you notice that there's a lot of hills, there's a lot of mountains, but there's a lot of entry points to Rome. If you go to Google Maps, which is kind of fun to do, and you zoom out to get the whole city, you can pretty much walk into Rome however you want to. But instead, he moves the capital to Byzantium, but then renames it Constantinople. Now, where is Byzantium located? Yeah, it's located in Turkey. I'm actually going to go to the next slide right over here. This is how the Roman Empire expanded under Constantine the Great. And you can see where Constantinople is. It's amazing, and I was in Istanbul probably about 6 years ago, and when you get there, it's amazing how hard it is to get into the city, because there's only a couple of specific routes that you can go. It sits there, and think about, and not just the strategic part, because it allows only limited access. Because not at this point, they still don't have large naval vessels. They don't have battleships. They don't have destroyers. They certainly don't have submarines. that they don't have an easy way to combat amphibious assault. You have to go through land bridges. You have to go across massive bodies. But you have these two large bodies of water. And on this side, it also, so you've got very limited range in which people can come and to attack you. But the other thing is, Byzantium stood as the crossroads of the East and the West. It was the trade capital of that region. If you go there today and you go into the Grand Bazaar, which is like knockoff Central, you walk around the Grand Bazaar and you see all these people from all these nations that are coming in and doing their business. In this day, it was when it was going, they would have all these kinds of things. People would come from the East with their spices. They'd come from the West with all their wool and their wares and all these unique things. It was a commerce capital. But then it also allowed him to put some actual stuff in place to keep people from entering the Black Sea to go in to easily do commerce. So he was able to exact some more taxation from people that were trying to get into the eastern regions. Constantine knew what he was doing. Now, when he shows up to Byzantium, it's like it's not this great cosmopolitan area. But by the time Constantine dies, it's become one of the more significant cultural centers in the known world. And he has that transition that goes on. So this is a really significant thing that he does. As you can see, across his empire, from when he got going, he was able to expand the borders as well. This is allowing him to reach farther. He's able to see what's going on. and he moves. So he moves in 324. He moves the capital, Byzantium. And then in 324, he also did this. He orders all military personnel to worship the supreme god on the first day of the week, which is Sunday. Now, notice how carefully we have worded this. It's the supreme god, and it's on Sunday. See, one of the things, and we'll see this about his influence on Christianity, Constantine had this habit of appropriating pagan holidays and overlaying Christian practices on top, or Christian festivals on top. Because the supreme god in the Roman pantheon at the time was the god of the sun, because the sun cannot be destroyed. Again, we're not, don't try to think in terms of a scientific people. Don't think with a scientific method. These people had no clue about all that. The sun was there every day. It cannot be destroyed. You can try to shoot an arrow at it with the strongest archer, and the arrow, and the arrow will never reach the sun. And these people had just some unique views on the world. So the sun god becomes, again, it's interesting that Egyptian mythology also has this with Ra. The sun god becomes significant. Now, he doesn't say they have to worship the Christian god, but he believes that the Christian god is the supreme god. So that's why we have Sunday. It's also, Sunday was being celebrated. You can actually go to the first chapter of Revelation. And this is interesting. This is sort of one of the things that you pick up when you read, but not just between the lines, but you read actually scripture, not just for some spiritual, but you read what's going on. By the end of the first century, the Christian church was celebrating its services, its main day of services, not on Saturday like the Sabbath with the Jews would do, but on Sunday. It was the day, that first day of the week. As it would happen. It wasn't the last day of the week because they had moved off because of persecutions. So he orders the military to do this. Now, this would have struck many Christians as increasingly odd because Constantine, again, did not immediately take on baptism. Don't think this wasn't lost on the bishops of his day. He didn't immediately adopt personal ascetic practices, which, again, wasn't lost on the Christians of his day. But now he begins the process of ordering, very slowly, the military to adopt Christianity. This would have been massively conspiratorial, massively controversial, because most Christians, and by most I mean about 95% of Christians in the early part of the church until this point, opposed military involvement. They didn't believe the military was something a Christian would be a good person to be a part of. If you were in the military and you converted, it was expected that you would leave that military service. If you were a Christian and you decided to go into the military, you were banished from your, or excommunicated from your church, because a good Christian didn't go into the military. There's a lot of reasons for that. But this would have been very unique. Ultimately, in 325, we'll keep moving along, he calls the Council of Nicaea to deal with Arianism. This was a political move as well as a power move, and also, I'll say, a theological move. But then in 337, as we mentioned before, he's baptized on Easter, just prior to his death on May 22nd. So these are some key life dates, and we don't want to get stuck in them too much, but we also want to talk about his influence on Christianity, because that's ultimately what we want to be able to see with all three of these people that we're looking at. One, he provided the broadest toleration of Christianity and ultimately made it the religion of the Roman Empire. This is extremely important because Christianity was growing. Christianity was in the midst of a significant period of growth. Now, during the second and third centuries, Christianity saw some of its most explosive growth in the regions where it was being persecuted, because the church always grows stronger because of persecution. But it was also seeing a lot of growth because the Christians were the ones that would run into the plague. They would run into the fire. They were the ones that were able to offer aid. They were the ones that came alongside people that were in need. They were providing for the poor. They were the ones that were known for giving of themselves and giving sacrificially. And I don't mean sacrificially as in offering a sacrifice to a pagan god, but giving of themselves because they saw themselves as living sacrifices. They took the words of the gospel very seriously. Now, it is worth discussing, as we'll sort of mention in controversies, whether Christianity is better or worse off because of what happened with Constantine. I'll touch on that here in a minute. It is thought that Christianity was growing significantly at this time and was growing throughout the known world. One of the challenges is we study the eastern part of Christianity, and by east I mean far east. Christianity was growing in China, what is now today China, India, Mongolia, Korea, and Japan. The challenge in Mongolia that they ran into in a couple hundred years is a guy named Genghis Khan, who ran into Christians and then he started executing all of them. In India, they ran into Buddhism or Hinduism, and that caused some problems out there. But here we see that Christians are in the midst of a period of growth. It is possible that Christianity could still have grown and ultimately become the dominant religion of the Roman Empire. But they didn't know that at the time. It was going to be another little bit of time before the Roman Empire would fall. I believe that in the gap between the Roman Empire and what was going to come next, in that time, Christianity very easily could have taken over as the dominant religion. Because it was growing at such a momentum, it was growing at such a pace. Just because a church doesn't have a building doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We think about Christians in China today. One of the largest groups of Christians across the world is the underground church in China. And they operate in exclusively clandestine and secretive places. There are some state-sponsored churches, but the problem is a state-sponsored church gets built, puts a cross on it, and about 6 months to a year later, the Chinese government will come through and just tear it down just for funsies. In this time, Constantine brings Christianity the political power of the throne of Rome. This is significant. But also, second influence, he assumed the title Bishop of Bishops, which led to lead the established church and maintain order amongst the factions. Again, Nicaea hadn't happened yet. Christianity has a lot of different groups, a lot of different denominations at this point. Some of them are in good faith of the apostles. Some of them are kind of outside. But Constantine wants to have as smooth of a process as possible. Now, this isn't the way that we understand politics today. This is politics infused with mythicism. This is politics infused with a lot of pagan cultural ideas. People led when a crow flew overhead at your marriage ceremony, you weren't going to have kids or something like that is what they believe. And there's crazy beliefs about things that would happen because it's symbolic. They didn't have a scientific method that was going on. They didn't have ways of explaining things rationally. This was a very dangerous time to lead. So if a man could come along and establish a religion that was both generous but had some power behind it, he could lead the empire better. And this is what Constantine does in part. hold on, let me get through a couple of these. The third thing that he did, he began the process of removing pagan symbols throughout the Roman Empire, while also building the first Christian churches. And then the basilica design is something that he ultimately used. Now, there were some Christian churches that existed before, but they weren't, well, one, there wasn't a ton of them. The earliest Christian church that we know of comes to us from around the mid part of the 300s. This is well after the Edict of Milan. Because Christians weren't able to meet in buildings. Well, why? Why weren't they able to meet in buildings? One, because, frankly, building material isn't that good at this stage of the game. But two, it was illegal to be a Christian. So you would see, now we can have a whole course on the architecture of early Christianity that would be very intriguing for me, but we wouldn't want people to attend it. But we also wouldn't want to put people to sleep. But there's some really interesting innovations that go on with large estates and how they would allow people, allow congregations to meet in their house because of a benefactor at this time. However, Constantine would use the basilica design. Now, this is the Basilica of Constantine. Obviously, it's not the actual one. But this is sort of the large basilica design that was becoming at the time very popular. You'll notice the large archways that exist, which are, you can't see my little pointer, the large archways, perhaps the greatest innovation architecturally that Rome provided was the Roman arch. That allowed the creation of these monstrosities. And he would use the basilica design as the foundation for Christian churches. And if you go to St. Peter's today, you'll find, and you go to a lot of cathedrals today, you'll find that the basilica design still exists, which you have at the top, you have the bema seat, you have the transepts on either side, you have the nave, the center aisle, the narthex, and the atrium. This design lasts until today. If you were to go to the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and you were to look at it from above, go to Google Maps again, you'll see this kind of a design. If you go to St. Peter's Basilica on Google Maps, and you look at it from above, you'll see the exact same design. This is a Constantinian design that existed. And this is actually a picture. When I was in the Roman Forum, I didn't take this picture, but you're able to walk all the way through all of that, and it's amazing how huge this is. I mean, this, at its time, at its peak, when it existed, this was a massive structure. If you're coming from the middle of nowhere, rural Roman Empire, let's say you came to Rome to trade some wares or to do some taxation with your mom or your dad, and you came across this structure, this would have been the biggest thing you've ever seen. In its day, it was like the Astrodome. It was the eighth wonder of the world. And the one thing that people would come to see it because they'd never seen anything like it. And some of you in here remember when the Astrodome was opened. You never saw anything like that before. And you would come, see, people would come to Houston just to see the Astrodome. It's like people go to Dallas just to see Jerry World. And what the park for the Dallas Cowboys. There's something powerful about massive buildings that exist that are well built. This was one of the biggest buildings of its day. And Constantine used this design to help the church expand. The basilica design ran throughout Christianity, but he also began a process of building churches. His mother went down to Jerusalem, and again, his mother had been named basically the mother of the empire, is essentially her title. And she had, again, access to what? The treasury. And it wasn't just access, it was unlimited access to the treasury. And so she goes down to Jerusalem, and her whole goal is to find Christian relics, because she had a very significant Christian influence on Constantine, and it's thought that she was part of his pre-conversion conversation that went on. And while she's down in Jerusalem, she believes she finds the place where Jesus is crucified, where Jesus is born in Bethlehem. So, and then she decides to build, and she ultimately goes and orders the building of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. And you can still go to Jerusalem today and find the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, where it was built. And if you're interested in finding Helena, you can go to the Cathedral of St. Peter in Trier, Germany, and look at her skull, because it's on display as a relic in the middle of the church, just in case you're interested. But she had a very significant influence. So the churches are going throughout the empire. These basilicas are being made. And what happens is Constantine uses Christianity to help propagate the Roman Empire. I'm going to keep moving on with this. So he established the Cairo as the sign of the church. So it's reasonable to ask, was Christianity better off because of Constantine? There's a really good book out there. There's a couple good books related to this, but there's actually a really good book by Peter Leithart. It's called Defending Constantine. And he goes through and talks about why the church is better off because of Constantine. Personally, and don't take my view as yours, figure out for yourself what you think. I think the church, by and large, is okay because of Constantine. I think there is a phrase out there called the Constantinianization of the church. I think one of the challenges is that the church moved from a grassroots organization of the way of Christ to a political organization that is not the way of Christ. There's a guy, he's a pastor of a church up in Minnesota, and he wrote a book. It was a couple of books that he's written. I'm trying to remember his name off the top of my head. I'll get to it in a couple minutes. But it was talking about the whole idea of how the kingdom of God works. And in the New Testament, we see that the kingdom of God comes underneath people, but political power comes over top of people. And Constantine changed the underneath people to over top of people of the church. And the church ultimately does suffer some challenges because of that. However, Constantine stood as sort of the rocket engine on the church to get it to become the global force that it is. Would it have happened? I think so. It would have just taken a couple hundred more years. And it would have been a little messier. However, because of Constantine, the church does move forward quickly and clarifies itself. Not being baptized until his death meant that he was never a Christian, though he did lead the church as the Bishop of Bishops. He overlaid Christian celebrations on pagan holidays, as we already mentioned. Christmas is one of them. And this whole idea of Sunday is another. There's some challenges that go in with this. but also he applied force and political cunning to establish his religious policies. Force and political cunning is not the way of Jesus. That's just not how we do stuff if we're Christians. But Constantine did, because again, he's coming with a different model. So I would encourage you, if you're interested more on Constantine, there's some really good books out there. Getting into that debate is very important. Let's talk next about a guy named Gregory the Great. Any questions about Constantine real quick? Any questions? Again, think about the time. The question is whether or not when people came to be Christian, if they had scriptures or just was it a witness? It was a combination of two. I would suggest that the New Testament was in place loosely by the time of Constantine. But again, you're living in a society with a 95% illiteracy rate. You didn't need a copy of the New Testament in your hand because you had a copy of the New Testament in your heart. And they would memorize scripture. People were in oral society. One of the things that we find in oral society is people were able to memorize massive stanzas of poetry, of thought. They're able to articulate stories very well because they know that they have to keep it. There's a process in your mind that changes. What made you a Christian, what really helped identify you with the label Christian at this time, is after you converted, you made your confession of your faith. Notice this process. I'm being very intentional about this. Your confession of your faith, which is Jesu Christu Kyriou, Jesus Christ is Lord, or you can do the Latin or you can do the French or whatever you want to do, but Jesus Christ is Lord. There might have been an old Roman creed at the time that would have been something like, I confess Jesus Christ is Lord, that God the Father sent him as the Son into this world and the Holy Ghost, something very simple like that. But then what would happen is your pastor would come alongside of you because you would be attached to a local congregation, and that person would walk with you for the next several weeks or months and help you begin growing in your personal discipleship and your personal followership. And then after a period of time of several months, you would go and be baptized. And at the point of your baptism, you would give your confession again before others. You would be immersed because immersion was still the dominant practice, almost the sole practice of Christianity at this time. And then you would be known as formally a part of the church. And many people still do this today in other locations. It's very different how we do evangelism from then. This method, again, the baptism is essential. The baptism doesn't save you. And this is something that I would challenge people on when they say baptism saves you, because I don't think at this point we see that, because people are delaying their baptism until Easter or Christmas. We find very early patterns of this because there's something powerful about being baptized on Easter. Now, I think the New Testament model is after you make your confession, you are saved, then you immediately go to baptism. Things change within a couple generations. That's sort of what happened. That's a long answer to a pretty simple question. Let's talk about Gregory the Great. We're not going to take too much time with Greg because there's not too much to say about him, but he's a significant figure that we need to get to. And then we want to talk about Muhammad. This is Gregory the Great. This is his icon that they would use in the Eastern Church. His life dates that we have about him are 540 to March 12th, 604. His title is the Bishop of Rome. He is Pope Gregory the First. So some significant life events. He was born into a wealthy, in 540, he was born into a wealthy Roman family. His father was a senator and would later become the prefect of Rome. And this meant he had a lot of access to estates, he had a lot of access to money. In 542, when he was 2 years old, the plague of Justinian kills off a third of the population of Rome. This is a massive plague. His family flees at this time. In 573, turns his family villa into a monastery. Somewhere in between this time, he became a Christian. He came underneath the teachings of Christianity, turned his estate into the monastery. It's dedicated to St. Andrew, and joined the monastery and committed to clerical life. In 579, he's named an ambassador to the court of Constantinople by Pope Pelagius II. And then in 590, he's named the Bishop of Rome, following approval from Constantinople. It's interesting, this happens to a number of popes. At this time, Rome is in ruins. Rome had fallen already, and it was the empire was essentially, it was a shattered. The Rome had fallen in 476, and the empire is in ruins. No one wants to be pope because the church is in ruins. But they elect Gregory because they know, they believe he has something about him that is significant, and that his significance is going to mean something. And what ends up happening is he denies his papal election, and he sends a letter to Constantinople saying, no, 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 I don't want to be pope. But somebody grabs the letter as it's going and throws it away. And then he realizes, oh, they're going to consecrate me no matter what. So he throws himself into his papal responsibilities, and he transforms the church. He transforms the Catholic Church, and he, what I believe, creates, even more than Leo I could have, the Catholic Church at the time. So in 591, he begins publishing various works, along with his commentary on Job and his rule for pastors, and then 604, he dies in Rome. So his influence on Christianity, he brought the Catholic Church from a place of despair and ruin to the doorstep of a golden age, and he really did this. He donates all of his family's estates and wealth, and he creates, in the what's ultimately the Vatican, he creates the foundation for the propagation of the church. Because of Gregory the Great, they're kind of still working off of the interest of what he gave them to a degree. Now, that's an easy thing to say because they really expanded, but he really established them. Number two, more than any other pope at this point, Gregory was able to lead the church and expand its missionary reach. This strengthened the church. Now, because he was the first monastic pope, this is a significant thing. He understands how he can use the monasteries to help move the church ahead, and he begins using the missionary efforts to do this. And as the first monastic pope, their point number three, he used the system to aid those in need, rebuild beleaguered Rome, and expand the church across Europe and into Britain. He sends Augustine of Canterbury and 40 monks into Britain and establishes the church in Britain during this time. Gregory's reforms to the priesthood have had a lasting influence to the current Roman systems. He ultimately reshaped the daily liturgy. He moved some stuff around, and as if you were to go into a Roman Catholic church today and look at their liturgy that they celebrate, several aspects of the Gregorian liturgy still exist. He changed where the prayers to the Father happen. He changed how they interact with the elements of the Eucharist and how this all happens. He reshaped the, and he also, Gregorian chant was created by him, or at least created under his system, because he created the Scala Cantorum, which is the school of singers. And if you've ever heard Gregorian chant, it's I think it's great, and it's still something that lasts to today. He's one of the most prolific papal writers to date, and his rule for pastors is a standard text. I had a friend that is a Roman Catholic priest that I knew growing up. He said, "Oh yeah, we're still using Gregory's text in our seminaries because it's the definition of what is a good pastor for us." And ultimately, he gave over his family's vast estates. A couple of the controversies, just to get to it. He enabled the doctrine of purgatory to find a place in Catholicism. The doctrine of purgatory is not a biblical doctrine. It's that if you die in sin, you have a chance to be redeemed into heaven. And if you can just get prayed for, or someone celebrates a mass in your honor, that kind of a thing. There's some more depth to it now than it was back then, but he enabled that to come in. But the other thing is he made Augustine the infallible teacher of the church, which Augustine basically says in his writers, I don't want to be an infallible teacher of the church. So Augustine wouldn't really care for that so much. So in the last couple minutes, I want to touch on one of the more controversial figures that we have, which is Muhammad. This is a depiction of Muhammad. Islam does not encourage depictions of Muhammad, but this is one that you'll find in a lot of places. This is the angel Gabriel giving the first revelation to Muhammad as he's in a cave. But there's not a lot of depictions of him out there, so it's not worth really using. So his life dates, 570 to June 8th, 632. And his title is the Prophet of God in Islam. And so we have his significant life dates that are out there. In 576, his mother died. His father had died 6 months before his birth, but his mother died and he was left an orphan at a young age. Then he goes through life, and ultimately in 610, he goes and he begins having, at the age of 40, a series of revelations. And these revelations, he says, come from God. In 613, he begins preaching God is one, and that we are to live in complete surrender, or Islam, to him. In 621 is the reported ascension to heaven. 622, he takes his followers and flees to Medina to escape the persecutions from the Meccan tribal factions. There's a lot of stuff going on at this period of time. Let me see this is a map of what we call Saudi Arabia today. It's Arabia back then. This sort of gives you an idea of what Muhammad had been doing. All the little X's are battles, and all those starry things are raids. But you'll see that Medina is, you can't see my little pointer, dude. But anyways, Medina is about halfway up in the map. Mecca's a little bit farther down, but Mecca is still considered a holy place. If you're going to go on Hajj, which is the pilgrimage, which is one of the five pillars, you go to Mecca. From what I've heard, it's an amazing place. So anyway, 624, he begins praying towards Mecca. Also initiates his pattern of raiding caravans to support his followers, and battles begin. One of the things that we'll just, even in a generous inquiry of his life, we want to make clear, Muhammad used the sword to bring about his rule. It's a very different way than Jesus' way, but he brought that with him. In 630, he attacks and sacks Mecca. I like the word sacks because it's the right British word for taking over a city. But he goes and he takes over Mecca with 10,000 of his followers. 632, he completes his first pilgrimage to Mecca. And then on June 8th, he dies in 632. Let's talk briefly about his influence on Christianity. I believe Muhammad is a significant influence on Christianity because at this period of time, he creates the last of the great three monotheistic religions. The great three monotheistic religions are what? It's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And if you get into discussions in interfaith dialogue, they'll talk about the three Abrahamic faiths because all three faiths go back to Abraham. Jewish people believe that lineage comes out of Abraham's son, Isaac. Muslims believe their lineage comes out of Abraham's son, Ishmael. And so it's Isaac and Ishmael. That's a really great West Wing episode, too, by the way. I'm a fan of the West Wing. There's a TV show from, I guess, the late 90s. It's really old now. No, early 2000s. But anyways, we'll leave that alone. But ultimately, we see that this is one of the major religions. Muhammad has an influence on Christianity because he changes the face of Africa and sort of the Near East, if you will. And frankly, he's changed the world because of it. So let's look real quick. Number one, influence on Christianity. The early encounters with Christianity were usually charitable, though full of misunderstanding. Fleeing Mohammedans, this is how they were known in his day, Mohammedans. They weren't known as Islamists. They weren't known as Muslims. They were Mohammedans. Were protected by Christian leaders or communities in various countries. When they go down and they flee, there's a whole group of them that flee to Ethiopia. There's a Christian king in Ethiopia that gives them protection and says, we will protect you. Some of the earliest encounters that Muhammad has himself are with Christians, because Christians are the primary religion in this part of the world still. And there's a story that there's an old monk that comes out and finds Muhammad and says that he's going to be a great priest or a great prophet of God one day. We don't know if that's true or if it's apocryphal, but it's what's used. Number two, most Christians thought his followers were a heterodox group of Arab Aryans because he denied Jesus' divinity. But they ran into him, and you read some of this early stuff, they're like, yeah, these guys are just a bunch of Aryans. We don't have to worry about them. They're kind of kooky, but they're just heretics. They didn't realize he was creating an entire different religion at the time, because there's a lot of misconceptions that are going on. Ultimately, number three, Muhammad would create the last of the three great monotheistic religions. Number four, in the few encounters between Muhammad and Christians in his lifetime, they were usually charitable and generous. Muhammad's followers, though, after his life, stormed the gates of the Eastern Church and would attack deep into the heart of Europe. And don't forget that in this time, Jerusalem falls in 635. And there's a good movie, I think it's a good movie, called Kingdom of Heaven. It's with Orlando Bloom. It's when he was making good movies. And he it's actually a great story about one of the part of the crusade that goes in to try to reclaim Jerusalem, or tries to defend Jerusalem from Saladin. It's a really well done movie. There's another movie that's out there called Agora that's helpful because it talks about the destruction of the Alexandrian library in Hypatia about this time. Though it doesn't, I believe, give an accurate depiction of Christianity. I think the movie maker guy, the producer, did something very uncharitable. It does give you a sense of what it was like to live at the time. We see, though, that after Muhammad's life, his followers storm the gates. They go after Christians. They go deep into the empire. This is the spread of Islam that happens. They go into Spain. They go into Byzantium. Who's one of the guys that stops them in 750? Charles Martel stops them. I mean, this is huge, big blocks. But Muhammad has a lasting influence on the church. Muhammad stated that Jesus was a prophet of God but wasn't his son and didn't believe that Jesus is crucified. And then finally, he founds a religion that would rival Christianity across the world for the last 1,300 years. I've got a couple quotes in there. If you want to read them yourself, this is what early Christians thought about Muhammad. It sort of gives you an idea of the interplay that was going on. Sort of the rhetoric is used. If you tried to go on television and use this rhetoric today, you would be yelled at on Twitter by people or Facebook. But it's not the kind of stuff that we use in common language today, but it was used back then. We use Muhammad as an example because he created a religion that ultimately rivals Christianity, and it came through a different system. It came by the power of the sword. And notice what Constantine did at the front. He came through the power of politics. But Gregory the Great re-energized the Catholic Church. Now, it wasn't the Roman Catholic Church at the time, and it certainly doesn't look anything like it does today through Vatican II, but Gregory used the missionary force of monasticism to expand the church and promulgate the gospel throughout Europe. And what ultimately happens, Gregory saves the church. He saves Rome. He ultimately saves Western civilization. Constantine did the same thing, but in a different way. And Muhammad brings the East into the West in a different way as well. Christianity is irrevocably changed through these three individuals. World changers happen. But ultimately what we see is through all of this, through all the darkness of Constantine perhaps, there's still the light of the gospel. Even in the midst of Gregory, who is able to go and reform the church, the gospel is pushed forward. And even though a pagan religion comes and asserts in an amazing way a different form of Christianity, the gospel still is something that is proclaimed throughout the world, and we can be thankful for that. So these are three world changers, just to give you a quick digest of them. Next week you'll see I've got on the back page, we're going to be talking about several great thinkers, and I've given you some good chapters to read. You'll be talking about Augustine, the Cappadocians, Ambrose of Milan, and Athanasius.